Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Robert?
Today, Russell, I am feeling fortunate. And I've been thinking a lot about good fortune and also chance. And today's guest's work has made me reminisce about chance in my own life where, you know, I think a lot of us study, especially for artists, actually, they study in quite a rigorous, intense academic way for many, 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 many years. It's actually a bit like if you're a doctor or something. I think people spend like, I don't know, 7 years or an architect or all these different professions where you have to really dedicate a long, long, long period of time to the end goal, which is becoming an artist, you know, as a professional thing, or maybe even just as a hobby. But it's still something that a lot of people dedicate their time to. And I was thinking about this meeting between the kind of academic rigor versus chance and what some people would say good fortune or even luck, perhaps. And even ourselves, like with Talk Art, it was kind of an accident. Like we've had a lot of good luck along the way, but at the same time, it was born out of both of our passion and dedication to learning and teaching ourselves about art history in all different ways, and also collecting art and stuff like that. And I love today's guest work, and I'm really happy because I saw their show at the Parasol Unit in 2015, which was an overview of 10 years of their painting, which at the time was such an impressive body of work. But now, almost 10 years later, I mean, it's probably 8 years later, but it's really interesting to sort of catch up with them and see what's happened, you know, through the pandemic. They've moved out of London and moved to Hertfordshire. And I'm really fascinated to talk about the meeting points between figurative painting and abstract painting, and this idea of kind of landscape, perhaps, but then an abstracted version of it, or, you know, like a cityscape, but an abstract sort of version of it, because I feel like that is what makes today's guest work so singular and exciting, are these meeting points between things that we all understand so well, but I feel like something very new is being created through their body of work. And Russell Tovey, you are like a massive, massive fan of today's guest.
Super fan.
And I'm grateful to you for championing them, actually, because you've really brought their work into focus for me in a way that, you know, kind of reintroduced me to their work when I was already aware of it, but I sort of hadn't thought about it as much recently. And I love her work so much. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art the one and only Katie Moran. Hi, Katie.
Hello. I was looking forward to that bit. No one's ever said my name in unison before. I can go now. Thank you. That was lovely.
It's like a very amateur church choir.
It's a bit like if you get your name on X Factor when they introduce you, like, Cher Lloyd. It's
The religion is art in this room.
Exactly. Where do we find you today, Katie?
I'm at Modern Art in Helmet Row. Yeah.
Oh, you're in London?
Room upstairs. Yes, I am. Yeah.
Have you travelled into London for things, art things going on at the moment, or are you in just specifically for Talk Art?
I've travelled in because I don't have a laptop, Russell. So.
Don't you?
I needed to borrow Modern Art. No, I don't have one. No, and I'm not au fait with them. So.
That's interesting.
Yes, I thought it would be handy to come here.
But we communicated through direct messaging on Instagram. So you have
Yes.
You have social media and you're but you just don't have a laptop.
I do have social media. I don't go on it very much at the minute. I've stopped scrolling on Instagram, which I'm quite pleased about. I just check it now for messages and things.
Well done.
Yeah, it feels quite crucial to me, actually, that I do that. And kind of building antidotes into my daily routine to combat the kind of mind-scattering effects of modern technology. Yes.
In recent times, you've moved to Hertfordshire, and I know before that you were in London as well, but has that had a big impact on the way that your work is progressing, like living in the countryside?
Yeah, I think I've always enjoyed solitude, and I definitely feel I get the solitude that I need, and life has slowed down. The pace of life is slower there. I definitely feel the difference now. When I drive into London, I mean, I love London. I love the intensity and the speed and the vibrancy, but it is quite an overwhelm on the senses, and I'm quite pleased to get out at the same time. I've also got a much bigger studio than I used to have, and I walk there now, and I walk through woodland to the studio, which is really nice. And my kids go off one way to school and I go off the other, and we all walk and we're home for like 3:15. So the quality of life is very nice, but I'm still close to London, so I can come in, see exhibitions, do, you know, run all my errands, do all my London stuff. So it's nice to have both. I don't think I could have one or the other. Yeah.
Is it important to you to have a studio that's separate from the home, like somewhere that you can, like you say, like you can make a walk there and a journey to sort of prepare your mind ready to tackle the painting?
Yeah, that is a really good question, because I know for some artists that's very important, the journey. I did work at home when I first moved to Hertfordshire. I had a studio in the garden, and I loved the immediacy of that, you know, being able to go in and check and look at things again. I do take my paintings home with me a lot, so I transport them between home and the studio and look at them in the living room. That's always useful because the living room is a lot smaller than the studio. The studio has a big ceiling, very high, very big. So, yeah, it's nice. Just recently, I wake up very early at like 4:30 or 5, and I have my little routine of doing things. I just started playing the piano, and I play the piano, do my meditation, do my reading. And I was thinking, yeah, if I was working at home now, I could pop into the studio, you know, and get some work done before the kids wake up. So I don't know is the answer. I do enjoy the journey. I like the walk.
I love the fact that you take the paintings back home with you to your living room. So you'd see them in a domestic environment. So they go from the studio, and before they leave you, you live with them, I guess. Do you have like a certain hook, a certain area or wall that they hang on?
Always in the living room. I say always in the living room. I've started moving things around. Like, I just painted my entrance hall, and that is very small. And I was experimenting with hanging different things in this space. And the reason I moved to this very big studio was because I got quite preoccupied with levels of experience. I would go and see exhibitions. Like, I saw the Lee Krasner exhibition at Barbican. And, you know, when you would sort of walk around the balcony, and you'd see a painting maybe from 100 meters away, or maybe it's like 50 meters away, and you get hit with that level of experience. And then you get the midpoint level experience, and then you get the very close up level of experience. I was very interested in that. And modern art moved to Vyner Street and had a big space, and I had a show there. So I was thinking about the impact of things from distance, which is one of the reasons I moved to this big studio. Was really funny because then, of course, modern art moved to the Mayfair space, which is small again. So, you know, that kept me on my toes thinking about this distance. But yeah, so I think it's useful for me to move them from the studio to the house to see them at different distances. But also because I never plan what I'm going to make, I find it useful to put them next to the sofa or something recognizable in a domestic setting, because sometimes I feel they help me to recognize it more quickly. I do it in the studio as well, put them next to a chair or a plant.
So you always picture them in the domestic? in some ways, before you release them, you know, because you have a gallery exhibitions, they might be going into a white cube environment before they go to a collection, but you yourself see them already like placed within a domestic environment.
No, I think that is tricky. And I think you have to be careful of that, because I've done a lot of decorating of my home recently. And I have been thinking about making paintings of certain colors to go in certain rooms. And I think you have to be very mindful of not confusing that with making art. And I was thinking this just yesterday, the art comes first and then you build in the domestic around it to complement. I don't feel it should be the other way around. Yeah, I definitely think you have to be careful of that.
And would the paintings go back to the studio? Would you then bring, so you bring them from the studio to your house and you look at them and you go, that needs more work, or that needs something else to it, and then you would take them back to the studio?
Yeah, often I do that back and forth. And it is a bit like trickery. When I take them from the studio and put them in the car, they suddenly look massive. And then in the studio, they look small. And yeah, it's quite funny.
It's interesting to me, this idea of like even, you know, placing a painting in proximity to a chair, say, and just the relation between, it's not even necessarily for me, what I think you were saying is to do with domestic. It's more to do with like space or objects in relation to perhaps.
Other objects, yeah.
I think there's definitely that element, but I think it's more about trying to speed up the process for me of recognizing them. Because it's very funny, right, when you don't know what you're going to make and you want the element of surprise to come in, you end up with something and obviously you can see it, but you can't tell. You can't tell if it's working or not. I think it's an effort to speed up that process, if you know what I mean. It's like once I had a painting, I finished it just before the show in New York. So I took it with me, but I couldn't quite tell if it was finished or not. And someone wanted to buy it, but I just said, oh, no, I can't tell if it's finished. So the gallery shipped it all the way back to London and I opened it in the studio. And the minute I opened it, I was like, oh, yeah, it is finished. But it's come all the way. Wow. I had a little pang of guilt that, you know, it'd come all the way back. But I couldn't have sped that process up. You know, it takes as long as it takes. So, but yeah, things inform things, don't they? So whatever you put next to something then informs. You know, it's like when I'm making the paintings, I feel like they're a continuum in a way. And they're all, you know, like words in a sentence, or they're all informing each other. And sometimes I find it quite hard to isolate or, you know, cherry pick which ones are the strongest on their own, because it's all done in the same breath, if you like. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you're an artist who has been collected by, you know, collectors, institutions, had your work on display in galleries for many, many, many years now. And I read somewhere that in your deepest kind of heart, you would have preferred it if you could have just kept all the paintings somewhere and then you could almost go back to a warehouse and just check in on all of them to see how they're feeling that day in relation to what you're making. I love that idea of like, wouldn't it be great if you could have just like kept all the work somehow?
It's something I suppose I don't dwell on because, you know, it's the deal, isn't it? And I'm very grateful to sell them. And yeah, then that affords me the money and time to make more. But no, totally. I mean, that would be the ideal, wouldn't it? Just have them all to be able to walk around every night, refer to them. Or would it? Maybe it wouldn't, because maybe it would draw you back too much. You know, maybe it's good that, because I do think I forget what I've done. And sometimes I do need to remind myself what I've done, because I've always wanted a plurality in the work. And room to manoeuvre, and I feel I'm always on to the next thing. So it is good sometimes to look back and remind myself of my interests and maybe revisit them. And recurrent themes tend to come back through anyway. But yeah, it's funny when I come across older works and they're me, but they're so very different. It's like when you look back at a photo of yourself, you know, 10 years ago, it's a moment in time, isn't it? We're always in flux. We're always changing. So, and I could never replicate that, you know, that was then.
I think the thing that I've always loved and always been drawn to is this, the found painting like the thrift shop find, the gold that you pick up in a charity shop that then you take home and then you rework over these paintings, which give it a kind of high-low effect. These are ready-made frames. These are ready-made prints, like low art that anybody can have access to. And then they come into your orbit and then they have this high art that is esteemed onto those, but yet you still acknowledge and respect the object that you're working on. When did that theme happen, and how do you stockpile all of these frames? Because they all kind of follow the same dimensions as well. They all have this kind of unique sort of sizing that is particular to you.
When did it start? I think I've always sort of included the found object. But I think, in the early days, I used to paint from images from my phone, which were probably actually images of paintings like the ones I now pick up. So it's kind of the same thing. Rather than paint from the reference on my phone, I now have the actual thing and work over it. Yeah, you said, how do I get them as well, didn't you? Yeah, there's a salvage shop on Goulbourne Road, and I know the guys there now. They're really nice, and they amass them for me, and they save them. So I go in when they've got a batch for me. So that's good. And they know what scale I like. And also, it's dependent on what I can fit in my car. There was something nice, but it was big the other day, and I couldn't fit it in the car. So it's like, well, no, can't have that then. Probably too big for me. Probably too big for me anyway. Because there is a certain scale, I think, where the illusion I'm trying to create works best. What was the other thing? There was about three questions in that question.
There was. That's a Tovey special for you there. I was asking about, when did you first find a found painting frame and decided yourself, you're going to paint over that? That's something that you're going to claim.
That is a good question. But I think what you were asking me was how I decide. And it's very intuitive, and it's not intellectually conceived in any way. It's just a felt thing, a kind of internal gauge, either I respond to it or I don't. I don't think through it much more than that. And then I just grab it.
And then when you start working on it, is it quite a daunting process to be faced with this? I'm picturing like the Haywain or something that you've got this print on it. Because there's always like an original work of art, whether that is a screen print or whether that is someone's, own sketching or painting on it. And then you have these wooden frames or these plastic frames at times, sometimes, but they have this history to them. So when you're faced with that, is it a daunting process to then attack it? Or is it quite a just, you grab one, you put it up and then you're off?
It's funny when you say they have a history. Some of them really smelt, like some have come from house clearances. They really have a strong smell. But then I think about the energy, because I'm a believer in energy as well. And you're thinking, where do they live? What energy has been imbued into them by the environment that they've been in, or the artists who painted them prior to me, and is that going to affect the result of this painting? It's daunting sometimes because I love them. So like I picked one up recently and it's so lovely. It's not enough, but it's got lovely things about it. I want to make sure I do it justice and make a good painting out of it. And I sort of have to be careful that I don't get too carried away. So sometimes I'll work quite slowly in the bits I paint over, leaving theirs underneath. And then I'll make sure I work over my painted bits, and I don't obscure any more of theirs. Like early on, it's definitely mine that need changing, not theirs, So, and then trying to allow the good bits to come through from their painting. And if you like, kind of refreshing the energy of their painting with what I add.
It's almost a collaboration with an artist you've never met.
Yeah, it's funny, because when you talk about it like this and I think about it in a rational way or an intellectual way, then yes, you would have all these kind of thoughts, but I don't really think about it in that way.
I think I've loved also the process that, and you can see like your fingerprints where that you move the painting around. So it's not like you work on it at one axis and you go, this is where it is, it's a landscape or it's a portrait. These move fluidly with the push and pull of your paint, the way you have this tension and your jesterly strokes, until you decide that you see an image and then you work into it. And this is something that I've really been fascinated by. And again, I guess this is you working in instinct, that this process has developed, that I can imagine you just twisting and turning, just trying to find something that speaks to you.
I think it's more trying to get fresh eyes. You know, like when you leave the studio and you come in the next day, that moment when I walk in the door is always really important for me, because it's the fresh eyes and you see things with clarity. So when I'm turning them, it's given me a fresh eyes moment. I'm able to see the paint marks with clarity. And this sliding scale of abstract to representational, or even if it's not figurative or representational, it's a moment of detail or tension or illusion in the painting. Then I turn it the other way and I can see if actually those marks are a little stale. Or sometimes the conscious mind sees a route to go and then tries to push that. And the conscious mind is limited. So I'm trying to open up all possibilities, the conscious mind, the subconscious, the unconscious, the intuitive voice. I'm trying to allow for all of these different things, and I'm very aware and alert to the voices that are going on telling me to do this or to paint this or to push that. But yeah, that's the turning element, I would say. And I paint with gloves, cotton gloves, and then vinyl gloves to protect my hands. And so I think the paint doesn't dry as quickly if the paint was on my fingers. It might be absorbed and dry quicker. So that is why the marks end up on the frame. But then, you know, sometimes I just feel they're integral then to the composition, or sometimes not. And I like the frame as a device for that. You know, it can be in the painting or it can be outside the painting.
I really love this idea as well, that these existing objects that have their own energies, they're almost like bodies, you know, filled with a history or with an energy force or something, how that then sparks you and your muse in a way to kind of, you know, take action and to have that response. It seems like such a unique thing, because you often hear of people saying like, oh, I heard a song and then it made me want to, you know, draw something, or maybe they read literature and they wrote a song after it, or you know what I mean, like that there's often something that might inspire your curiosity or your creativity. But I'm loving this kind of, it's very intense, like, you know, and you seem to really respect that connection.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely do. I love these things, but so I don't know how interesting I find it, because I think it's instinctive and in a way ineffable and unknowable why we're kind of drawn to these things. But, you know, I mean, you think about high art, low art, like Russell was saying, kitsch, taste, taking things out of context. You know, I've seen like great artist paintings taken out of context, and I don't know if you would know that by that artist or by an artist of that caliber. And it, you know, it throws up these questions, you know, my pathology, where I grew up, domestic again, you know, my parents' house, my grandparents' houses, my first kind of experience of curated spaces, you know, and the art that would hang on the walls, like all the things I've seen, the visual memory. I mean, how would you ever work out why? And that's why I don't know how interested I am in that. As in, you know, really trying to get to the knob of what is this about? I don't know that it matters. I just trust the intuitive response. Or even if you tried to gauge it, who knows, it would be right.
But I've read that you always see the paintings as figurative. That's something that you've... You know, that's what you're trying to find in the work, even though they are abstract to an audience.
I think there's definitely been phases where I would see them as more figurative, and then I would try and push this narrative. But it would then become tricky because I'm sacrificing the paint and the freedom of the paint to close down this narrative, so that the viewer will see this and understand this, because it means something to me, but who's the viewer? And would they even see what I see? And then at what cost to the freedom and energy of the paint? So I think there's definitely, I feel like there's, in the paintings I make, I sort of lump them into categories. They're kind of lazy categories, but I suppose paintings that are more from an abstract expressionist territory to paintings that are more from a surrealist territory. And then someone said some of the paintings felt like 1960s Italian paintings. And now I like holding that in my head. And I'm not even sure I know exactly what that means. But to me, I feel like there's an oddness about them. And then there's sort of like a 1950s, 60s, but then like a 70s, 80s color fade thing going on. But anyway, in the surrealist kind of territory, I feel there are more figurative things that recur, like surrealist eyes, clown's faces, playing cards, things from sort of still life. Like I hold Henry Ploberger in my head, this kind of surrealist still life painting that I saw one time in New York. So whereas the abstract ones are not about that, but I suppose in the way that the figurative element, if you like, would be the detail, the sense of illusion, the tension in the abstract painting. So yeah, I guess that answers the question, isn't it?
Well, they feel timeless, and I don't know if that is because you have these, the frames in some ways are ancient and modern and kitsch and contemporary, or you know, they come from a certain place. And the painting is you can't, you know, you'd make a painting today, but what's unique to you is that it does feel timeless in the way that Howard Hodgkin sort of works. And they feel, you know, obviously they are historic now, but when they were contemporary, they still felt they were historical as soon as they left. And he likes the device of the frame and the found frame and the found object and working over that. That is a unique energy that you are able to imbue in these works, is that they feel like they've been around for a long time.
That's very nice of you to say that they feel timeless. Thank you. But I definitely like old. I like things that look old and are weathered. Definitely not put off by that. It's interesting that you talk about a timelessness, because it makes me think more about, I suppose I have an intuitive resistance to a school of thought or a trend or a fashion I've always sort of resisted that, because I feel, you know, good art isn't transient and it does need to be timeless. And if you free yourself of current schools of thought, fashion, conversations, then you have some freedom in that way, but you also risk ignorance. So it's a balance, I think. It's a delicate dance.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting what Rob was saying in about how, you know, in 2015, the Parasol Unit show, which was a kind of survey show of yours, and here we are 8 years later. And I read that something that stayed with you from your MA was a tutor talked to you about the difficulty of sustaining a career. And what has it been like for you? Because right at the beginning of your career, there was a lot of hype around you, and you were flipped in auctions, and you were bought by the Rebels, and you had the Pinot collection. You had a lot of attention on you. And everything I've read at the time is that you were just like, it's the work, which is the best way through it. But it's interesting now to have a conversation about sustaining this career and how that's been and what that is, what that feels like.
That's such a good question, Russell, because it's something I think about all the time. Because as artists, you know, we don't have a template. There's no template for how to do this. And since the Parasol Unit show, I started thinking a lot more holistically and thinking about the mind and how to optimize the mind and creativity and where you put your energy. And like you say, how do you sustain this? Like, regardless of what is going on, like you say, externally in the market with sales, anything like that. You know, I'm a fan of tennis, and I was thinking about tennis, and they say that is, you know, one of the most isolating sports, because you're on your own at the end of this court. But even tennis players have coaches who are advising them about how to play. And as artists, when you paint like I do, there's no one can help you with that, with the actual painting. And so I feel it's crucial, especially now, to really protect and cultivate creativity and secure your creative inspiration. Very interested in flow state. So I've been very interested in cultivating flow state when I'm in the studio.
Can you explain what flow state is?
So you might know it more as being in the zone. And as an actor, you know, performers talk about getting themselves out of the way. So Stephen Kotler has written a few books on this, on flow state and how to optimize it. But basically, when we go into flow state, large swatches of the prefrontal cortex shut down, which is like our inner critic, like our inner Woody Allen, like our neurotic cells. That goes offline. And we are able to access what researchers call the deep now, or the elongated present, which means we can't think about the past or future. We are purely in the moment, and our concentration, our focus, our creativity is all enhanced. And it's, you know, the optimal state really for creativity, for all kinds of performance. And this is what I feel now. It's almost irrelevant what we're doing, whether you're an artist, an actor, a business person, an athlete. It's less about what you're doing, but it's more about cultivating the states necessary to go into flow state or to get the right results. So I've been very interested in, thinking as much about what I'm doing outside the studio as I am inside the studio. Just like an athlete, you know, will tinker with every aspect of their day, you know, all to enhance this 2-minute performance or 2-hour performance or whatever it is. And yeah, I've been trying to, I thought a lot about securing like a visual hypersensitivity so that I'm always inspired, because I believe it is possible, entirely possible, to cultivate these states. And crucial for an artist, because that is one of the things we need to secure, inspiration, so that we're always inspired. And that, you know, it's like Picasso or Paul Klee. It's really crucial. And now, like I was saying, now with this modern technology and all this shallow focus and distraction, it's really important to build antidotes into your daily routine to have these different periods of flow state. I've also done transcendental meditation recently, which I find has been very helpful for that kind of mindfulness, which helps with the inspiration as well.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Art, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also given people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake.
Earlier on, when you said about how the paintings almost reveal themselves to you, you know, during the process of making them, they kind of start to say that they're finished. So I was really interested in how art has kind of helped reveal yourself to you, in the sense that I sometimes feel that great art can help an individual to kind of like get back to their sort of true self or their core, or sort of like strip away all of the layers that we've kind of wrapped ourselves up in, you know, growing up as a teenager, as a young adult, all these things you kind of put armor on, or you know, you start to act in relation to society. And there's something about your work that I just feel is so and I think it's getting even more so, like the Speroni Westwater show you did, which had all the kind of green, you know, really rich tapestry of colors. There was something so almost like pure soul for me, like as a viewer, like looking at that work. It feels really authentic and honest and kind of joyous as well. Like, has your journey being an artist, like that kind of long struggle, helped you to sort of be yourself, if you know what I mean, like become more secure as an individual?
I definitely think the way of painting, the way of being in life is inextricably linked. And I feel like, yeah, the way I think about painting, the way I think about living, yeah, is the same, as in, well, there's lots of things. The conscious mind being limited surrendering to the flow of life, to what is, accepting that the conscious mind doesn't always have the answers or know what's best for you in life and in painting. Yeah, I suppose it's a gift, really. But I think when you say struggle, I think a lot about challenging belief systems. And, you know, if you think painting is going to be a struggle, then it probably will be. Whereas if you think it's joyful and great fun, then it probably will be. I think the work on the mind and you know, I think about Carl Jung because he resonates a lot with me, this idea of the second self and the interior self, which is separate to the physical world that we live in. And that I definitely identify with that. And I feel I've cultivated that in the studio. And it's like this cultivating this rich inner world or plurality of selves, which, you know, it's what you, I suppose, yeah, it's inextricably linked, the painting me in life and painting, it's all the same. But I definitely feel in terms of sustaining, like Russell was saying before about sustaining the career, it's all about experimenting and challenging and pushing and, you know, am I awake in all these different areas of my life and self? And then, you know, how is that going to feed into the painting? And yeah.
Do you think about the response to the work and the viewer? Or like, do you have any intentions to sort of, because I just feel, I know it sounds really odd, but the more I've started to look at your work, even in the past few days, I feel it opens me up. You know what I mean? Like almost kind of like open heart surgery, that kind of feeling you get when art can sort of feel like you can bear yourself. Yeah. There's something very, I don't know, like it's almost like I'm revealing myself while looking at your works. It's quite an intense thing. And I don't know whether that's something, it's probably not something you intend, but I do feel like your work has that potential.
That's so nice. Thank you. I definitely think about the energy of things now. Like I, at Christmas time, you know, I was buying presents and wrapping them. And previously I might have, you know, bought something and then wrapped it in a hurry. And then this time I was really mindful that everything was enjoyable, sourcing the present, wrapping the present, so that when I gave the present to someone, it wasn't like, you know, Merry Christmas, here's a bundle of my hassle and stress. Like, you know, it was like, I'm thinking about the energy of what I'm putting out, but obviously there needs to be rigor and challenge and discernment in the paintings I make. But I suppose it's hard for me to be objective to think about what my paintings might be offering up. But I do think a lot about, in terms of what I was saying before, about I believe that we can all access these states of being which allow us to operate at the height of our powers, to express our unique potential most effectively. And I look at other performers in different fields and what I get from watching them and what states I think that they are probably in, you know, in flow state, when they've produced these things. And I sort of ask the question, what would that mean if that is in painting? What would one feel if that is achieved, that kind of energy? You know, what would it be giving off? I can't answer that because I'm the maker, I suppose, but it's really nice that you say that.
So with this, I mean, I just wanted to say that the bundle of hassle and stress just gave me a flashback to my mum at Christmas as a kid. And I'm just like, I know that when she's listening to this episode, she's going to be nodding, going, yes, yes. But when you're saying about this being completely in the moment, do you finish most of the paintings in one session then? I know you've talked about you take them home and sometimes you do that, but instinctively, are they normally done within one session?
No. I think I used to like to do them in one session because I felt like the energy was of the moment and I wasn't sure I could go back in with a new energy and finish it. But again, that was just the belief system.
Right.
A belief system that I needed to get over. So I think the potential for making a painting in one sitting is there because of the way I work, and I love the excitement of that it could happen in 10 minutes or it could, you know, it could take a day or a week or months or years. So every sitting is an attempt at painting, if you like, but invariably they're sitting upon sitting, attempt upon attempt, if you know what I mean.
Mm. I love this belief system that you've sort of cracked the code for.
I've not cracked the code. I mean, I think it's a practice. It's a practice. But yeah, I think, you know, we have to challenge belief systems. But, you know, I read a lot, and there's a lot of books. People in personal growth will talk about challenging belief systems, because basically we get to define our reality. There's this thing about great people bending reality to their whim. Like Steve Jobs, for example, had a sort of reality distortion where he believed that the rules didn't apply to him and he could bend reality. And I think this, I'm definitely interested in that, because we create our own reality. And it comes back to energy again and what vibration we're operating at and what we attract into our lives. And I'm interested in that.
Rob mentioned about how do you consider an audience, how they feel about your work and how he's personally been affected by it recently. But I've always felt like the titles for you are very important and very funny at times and humorous, and kind of then they're nothing at points and then they're everything. I've always felt like they're an aid that you're giving to the works for an audience to see what you're seeing in the work, or you want them to see what you're suddenly seeing.
They used to be, they definitely used to be that. But I think now it's more about me, like an aid to remember for me. Like this show I have coming up in Australia, the show is called More Me, and I've called the paintings More Me because this idea that with transcendental meditation, it promotes self-actualization, which is more expressing your unique potential, if you like. And I had a moment in the painting where I felt like my preoccupations with the paint and the particularities of the paint as a medium were coming through with real clarity. And I felt this moment of possible self-actualization. And, you know, sometimes when you have these little moments and then you integrate it, or it becomes the new normal, or you kind of think, oh, did I feel that? Or was it, you know, how real was it? But it definitely felt like a thing. And so for me, I called the paintings More Me. And I was sort of thinking, how many shall I call More Me? How important is this for me to remember that this was important, feeling this way? So I think I've called about the last 10 paintings More Me. So I think that's probably enough now. Don't know. We'll see.
This has opened at Station Gallery in Melbourne. This is about to open there. What? And are you going to go out there and see this, or has it just gone off?
No.
So what's that like, knowing that there's an exhibition curated and showing that you're never going to see in the flesh?
Oh, that is a good question. Yeah, because I'm not sure if I've ever not seen a show that I've done. They asked me, I think, we could do a live Zoom to curate them together. But there's only 7 of them and they're quite cohesive. So I think it will be quite easy to hang them, if you know what I mean. I think they all will work quite well together. Yeah, I suppose it is a little sad that I won't get to see them hung. Hey-ho.
Hey-ho. Can I just mention some of the titles that have been lovely for me that have stayed out? I think Lady Bear with a Back Full of Hair.
Oh, that's hilarious. I've forgotten all about them.
Still Life with Nothing. Mickey Mouse Moran. That's a favourite of mine. Yeah. I love that one. These titles are hilarious and brilliant. Mickey Mouse Moran.
Mickey Mouse Moran. Well, my son's called Mickey. I do have a bit of a Disney thing. Yeah, comes through in the paintings.
Has being a mother affected, you know, are you saying your kids have certain hours now? And I think when we're trying to get the episode today, there's only a certain window of opportunity with you to do this. Has being a mother affected your time in the studio and your ability to make work? And when you're in the studio, the kind of, obviously that you have a lot of focus in that studio time, but has it given the practice something completely new?
Massively. You know, like in that film, As Good As It Gets, when Jack Nicholson says to, what's her name, Helen Hunt, you make me want to be a better man.
Yeah.
That's the effect that the kids have on me. You know, they make me, make me want to be a better man, make me want to be a better person. And when they were born and then I got divorced and I'm a single parent, I thought a lot about where I put my energy and where to drop the ball. I think ever since then, it's been this is why I've started to think more holistically and trying to optimize creativity and how I spend my time. And because it's such a thing to try and be the best for your kids and then try and keep making the best painting that you can, that doesn't happen by accident. And this comes back to the template, you know, what template am I going to create for myself? Yeah, so no, it's been a massive thing, I would say.
If we look back to your childhood, so you grew up in Manchester, and I believe both your parents were art teachers.
Yeah.
So what was Manchester like as a kind of place to grow up and creatively? Like, I heard that you had, like, you know, you even saw art hanging at home, perhaps, or your parents' friends' homes, or things like that. Like, can you speak a bit about that whole time?
Not original art in people's homes, I wouldn't say, but my mum and dad had a lot of David Hockney prints and books in the living room. Yeah, so a lot of that. I remember my mum and dad had like a big pop art life-size Superman kind of going down the stairs, you know, stuck on the wall. So yeah, there was lots of kind of fun, interesting art around the house. And then my grandparents were very different because you know, obviously a different generation. One set of grandparents were Irish immigrants. The other may have been Irish, but denied it. But there a lot of religious kind of iconography and things and in those homes. But Manchester was great, a great place to grow up because, you know, we had Manchester. We had that time with the music, which was a real moment. You know, my brother was a musician and he had some success with his band. And so I often think about that time and think, you know, it made you see. I think at that time it was very Manchester-centric, you know, which is easy to get with about London, I think. It's become quite London-centric. But then I was Manchester-centric and I think, yeah, it sort of can't be underestimated what effect that has when you see that those things are possible. You know, when all these bands in Manchester are having great success and doing so well, and then, yeah. I'm trying to think, what else did you ask me about Manchester?
It was just kind of about growing up there and the fact your parents were art teachers. I found that that's obviously quite a unique experience to have two very art-loving parents in a way.
Yeah, I think it is. But, you know, when sometimes you're in it and because they were both art teachers, you sort of don't realise how that's affecting you. But I did, after my son was born, I wanted to try different things. I was going to learn Italian and I did a week's acting course to see what that was like. And I remember sort of thinking about it, thinking, wow, you know, if both of my parents had been actors, how would I have thought differently? As in, both my parents were art teachers. And so I was doing this art from an early age, but it's like a detached thing. Whereas acting to me felt about the physicality, you know, being in this body and using it. And I thought, yeah, how would I be more aware of my physicality, or how would that have changed? Yeah, I think it obviously shaped me because I think there's definitely a way that they thought and definitely aesthetics over function. Definitely a big thing in our family. Yeah, always aesthetics over function.
So you'd have like a nice looking chair, but it'd be incredibly uncomfortable, but it'd look good.
Yeah, definitely, like prioritizing that to a fault, perhaps.
Quite like
now
that.
I'd need to be mindful of.
I think my boyfriend would nod along to that and be like, that's what I need. It looks good.
He really,
it's like,
would,
you can't
Steve.
Sit
Poor
on it.
Steve.
I'd be like, yeah, but it looks good. Just leave it. Just leave it.
The thing is, your dogs always make things like, they sort of take it over anyway.
Yeah.
And also, I read that you were really into illustration early on, and Kit Williams was a kind of formative inspiration.
Oh, yeah, Kit Williams. Yeah, so, yeah, amongst the David Hockney books and prints were lots of, Kit Williams books and Masquerade. Yeah, this kind of rich detail and imagery. Yeah, I've not thought about him for a while. But, yeah, I did. It's true. I studied illustration and then Yeah, halfway through my degree course, I realized that I wanted to paint. And they told me that I'd failed the course and not to do it. But I did it. And, you know,
well done.
It doesn't matter now, does it? But
Did you always have that kind of conviction of and like self kind of self-possession or something? Because I feel like there's a lot of things in your story where it seems like you do have a inner confidence or strength or something for protecting what it is you want to do. Like you make a decision and you're like, actually, this is, I like illustration, but painting is, I'm a painter. And you make that decision, even though everyone around you is like, you're going to fail the course. Maybe you should reconsider. But where does that come from?
Yeah, I've thought about that sometimes because, you know, it was, I felt like it was me and my dad from an early age. Like my dad taught me to draw and he was very passionate. He'd get very excited. And I wonder whether I had that confidence because it felt like we were a bit of a team, if you like. And it's funny even saying it now because going back to what I was saying before about being so autonomous and isolating, if you like, it's only ever been me. But yeah, when I think back to that time, it did feel like a team thing, which is nice. So I don't know if the confidence came from that relationship or whether it was innate, but I've definitely always had a strong sense, yeah, of what I felt to be right and a refusenick about rules, you know, whereas in other areas of my life, I would definitely defer to others for advice or follow the rules, especially where health and safety would be concerned. But I did not like rules in art at all. I did not like anyone trying to impose them. Still don't like it. Don't like agendas, schools of thought. No.
Before we get on to our final questions, I want to just talk about your palette and how it's changed over the years. To begin with, when we were first seeing your works, it was very vibrant, and then it's sort of taken on a muted, grungy palette, and now there is an oscillation between the bright, a lot of reds and oranges, and then we have this muted palette again. Can you talk about your colour choices and what that instinct is and how that has changed?
I think I correlate now the palette with my well-being. I'm mindful and intentional of like I was saying, the energy I put out, the colours I might want to use. But I also follow whatever I feel an affinity to or tune into in terms of colour I will go with. But I feel like the palette has lightened more recently. Like I was looking at a batch of salvage paintings that I collected just the other day in the studio, and I looked at them together. And I immediately thought, all this needs to be lifted. The palette needs to be lifted a good few notches, which I'm pleased about because I think it indicates a happiness, a good state of being.
Oh, well, that's brilliant to hear, Katie. That's amazing.
Yeah. Mm. Well, thank you. Yes, I'm glad I'm mentally well.
Alongside the importance of colour in your work, how important is collage? And do you still sort of make collages?
So I sometimes use my bum in my painting now. I make bum prints. Do you know that?
No.
I didn't know that. Oh, okay. Bum.
Yes, I sit on them. Yeah.
Wow.
Back in 2020, I started doing that.
On all of them, or is it always a surprise? A lot of them. Do we know as an audience if your bums touch the paint or not, or is it something just for you?
You know, I did think of doing a little signature like bum logo so that I needed to remember for me to know which ones I'd bum printed and which I hadn't. Like make a little stamp of a bum. Yeah,
I love that so much.
So it's definitely more me.
I should
more,
do.
More you.
More
it is
me.
More. It's
yeah.
A lot more of you. Yes.
That is something I didn't know. Yeah, I read about collage, but I hadn't
I didn't
read
know
about
your bomb was present.
Okay, yeah. 2020, the bomb made its appearance. Yeah.
How did that come about? What led to that? Love this.
Well, when I moved to this bigger studio and I was thinking about the intentional brush stroke, and then I was thinking about how I could make a bigger mark, but without using the intentional brush stroke. And then I was looking back at Yves Klein body painting, and then I just sat in it, in the studio without, like, I wear incontinence pants now, but I sat in it without any on. So paint got in some places, which is not great.
I guess your studio should be quite private at this point, right? You sat in Constance pants sitting on all the paintings. This isn't really like your studio visits. This doesn't happen when you have an audience there, I take it.
No, I put the Inconstance pants away when anyone comes to visit.
I love this.
I did realise I'm putting them through as my expenses to my accountant with no explanation. And he's not said anything, but I was thinking, he must be wondering why I'm sending these receipts for Inconstance pants through to him. But so going back to the question about collage, I started, when I was using the bomb, the bomb print would be round, but then I started using masking tape so that then I could bomb print different shapes. And then sometimes the masking tape would get covered with paint. And so in that way, it would end up being collaged as part of the painting. So that is the only collage that I've sort of incorporated almost by accident, really, recently. Yeah, and I'm into the kind of the bum and roll. So sitting in it and then rolling it.
Around your bum.
Canvas up and rolling. No, not rolling around my bum. I'm sitting in it and then lifting it, and so it rolls and drips.
And that approach to mark making is literally part of a response to trying to push to a new place, like so that the mark making itself looks different.
Well, I like the mark that the bomb creates, but also I like the fact that it's accident and chance. You know, you can't orchestrate that. You don't know. I mean, you know kind of what mark it's going to make, but you don't know exactly. So I like the surprise element of that, but also the energy, the fresh kind of energy of that amongst the brush strokes.
It's like this dedication to your art, and how that intense, you know, the days and days, the weeks and weeks, the years and years of dedicating yourself to one thing like painting. Like, it's so wonderful that you can explore different ways of mark making. It's just, I don't know, I just find that super cool, that exploration and that experimentation and spontaneity.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been a fan of accident and chance. Yeah, and I like that element, and then preserving, you know, the skill is in preserving, you know, which part of the accident, and trying to keep the energy of the accident across the whole of the painting. But yeah, I feel like it's just another tool in the toolkit, you know, it's just another way.
Cool.
I love that.
I love that.
Well, we're going to get onto our final questions now, Katie. I know that you've got a car on a parking meter, so we'd be quick.
Driven in London, that's a serious
thing. Yes, exactly. That's a serious crime. That's a crime, Katie. So if you could do an art heist and you could have any work of art in the world for yourself, what would that be and why?
Helen Frankenthaler, I think.
Oh, nice. A big, big one.
That would be lovely. Oh, a big one. Yeah, that would be lovely, wouldn't it? And then I would bathe in the colour. Lovely colour.
Why is she your number one? Is it the gesturally energy that she's able to bring into every work?
I think it's just the expanse of colour. I love how it soaks into the canvas. Like, she uses the unprimed canvas, I think, doesn't she? I love the simplicity and the colour and the way it bleeds into the canvas. They're just lovely.
Well, I guess, and that leads on to our next question about colour then.
Yeah, our next question is, what is your favourite colour and why?
I think in the studio, my favourite colour would be Titan Buff, which is like my default setting.
I've never heard of that one. What is that colour? I don't paint, you see.
Titan Buff, yeah. It forms the base of a lot of my paintings. It's like a sort of retro, creamy, off-white colour.
Okay.
So that is the one I use the most, I would say, which is kind of a non-colour, isn't it? A neutral. And then in life, I would say Racing Green is my favourite.
That's Racing Green?
That's what you've just painted your house, Racing Green.
I've just painted my entrance hall green. I'm wearing Racing Green. My car's Racing Green. Yeah, love it. Yeah.
Who is your paint company of choice? Who do you use?
Golden.
Where are they from?
I think they're Californian, but I use acrylic paint. So, and I like the fluid acrylic paint.
Very nice.
Do you use acrylic, Russell?
I wear acrylics sometimes on my fingers, but no, I don't paint. No.
No.
Okay.
No.
You have painted occasionally, Russ.
Yeah,
I've been on Wes Perry's TV show.
I mean, yeah, but I wouldn't.
He does it for like fun.
I don't have it.
And actually, I think he's into drawing, because if we sign our book, he always does little cartoons. And I think Russell, I don't have anything like that. The only thing I've done is like hearts and crosses, like Kylie Minogue.
Yeah.
Yeah. Literally, when I was about 8 years old, I used to do my own signature, copying Kylie's with a heart and an X.
You still do.
Still do. And that is the last time I made art. Okay. I literally stopped.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you my medium of choice.
That's why we love art so much, because we don't really make it ourselves.
We're fans.
You know what else? Can I quickly just ask? How does sound influence you? Because I've read you talk about sound before, and I know you've even been interested in like sound baths and almost like not therapy as such, but kind of like, you know, how sound can impact you as a person. But does sound influence your work at all? Do you listen to music in the studio? Is there?
Yeah, I do actually listen. How do you know about sound baths? I mean, I have been to sound baths, but.
Have read a lot about Katie Moran. So somewhere along the way, you've briefly mentioned it. And I actually know someone in Margate who does sound baths as a thing. And I went to one recently. We did it in the gallery, actually, at Carl Friedman Gallery one evening. And it was really impactful and an amazing thing, like to have resonance and vibrations. And I'm just interested because I know you're interested in all kinds of things like Feng Shui and all of these different histories.
I did sound therapy quite a while ago, back in 2015. And so I listened to Mozart and Gregorian chant for 2 hours a day for 2 weeks at different frequencies. And basically I did it to help process trauma, but it ended up having an effect on my painting. It kind of changed the brushstroke and the palette. Everything emptied out. And I did a show in New York that were all white paintings. But basically, the woman who took this sound therapy course, she was an ex-opera singer, and she advised that I listen to Mozart on analog when I painted. So for 5 years, I listened to Mozart, the same record over and over again on a record player.
Wow.
And I couldn't even tell you which record it was. Because it wasn't really about, you know, it was just, and again, it was like a belief system. I felt like this was helping me paint. But then I read about the heart intelligence, and the heart is made up of about 40,000 neurons, which play a central role in shaping emotion, perception, and decision-making, a bit like the gut, you know, is the second brain. And I was reading about how uplifting music, can help sort of fire up the heart intelligence. So then I went back to listening to what I like, because this opera teacher had said that pop music was the equivalent of junk food. So I'd stopped listening to that. But now I've started again. I listen to whatever I like and I love it.
You just binge out on that pop music. Mm. It's the McDonald's of sound. We love it.
What is the what's the best advice you've ever received, Katie, when it comes to your art? What's the best advice you've ever received?
I don't think it was advice, but I think it was what you were saying, the question that was posed, you know, how do you sustain your career? How do you sustain the excitement and passion for your career? But also just, someone once said to me something along the lines of, someone's got to be an artist, why not you? And I think when you're young, that's quite a good one. Just to remember, someone's got to be one, why not you?
Yes, I love that. I love that for anything. That's great.
Well, exactly.
Well, this has been heaven. You're not going to get a parking ticket. I think we're going to get out of here in time.
I'm not. We're on the right side of the law. 12 minutes on the right side of the law.
What's next for you, Katie? You've got a show, as we discussed, opening up a station gallery in Melbourne titled More Me, with your bum all over it.
Yeah.
What is the next exhibition coming up for you?
Doing a limited edition bum print for Tate, St. Ives.
Are you really?
Yes, so that will be, for their anniversary. And then, just... I think art for Freeze New York.
Well, this has been amazing. Thank you so much. For everyone listening, go to Instagram and see images of everything we discussed in today's episode. Katie, you're on Instagram as well. And is it just at Katie Moran?
Katie Moran 123.
At Katie Moran 123. And we're at Talk Art. And thank you for today's chat. It's been so wonderful to get to know you better. It's really nice because I've always really respected your focus and the really sort of direct way you will talk about making paintings and how important it is to you. But it is also really joyous to hear your kind of humor and lighter side alongside the kind of, pursuit of freeing up that energy to make work and get into the zone. I mean, I just find that so inspiring. It's a really great lesson for all of us. So thank you, Katie Moran. We'll be back very soon. Thanks for listening.
Take care, everyone.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Katie.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.